Question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just
a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, September 30th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
An exclusive interview with two students of the Irvine 11 telling their story in depth for the first time. And Mark Levine returns from Tunisia, the site of the first revolution of the Arab Spring. We'll get a report back. Plus, Rethink Reviews by Jonathan Kim. But I can't help myself,
why should I? This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. An Orange County jury on Friday, September 23rd, found 10 of the so-called Irvine 11 students guilty of disrupting a public meeting and conspiring to disrupt a public meeting. The misdemeanor charges were brought over their actions during a speech by Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren on the campus of UC Irvine in 2010. Members of the Muslim Student Union stood up one after the other during the speech, interrupting Ambassador Oren from speaking, and walked out, only to be arrested. UC Irvine's administration disciplined the Muslim Student Union by suspending its charter for one quarter and placing it on probation for 2 years, even though they maintained that they, as a group, did not organize the action. However, Orange County District Attorney Tony Rakakis picked up the case as a criminal matter, charging the individual students with conspiring to commit a crime. The case attracted national attention, and many people, including some who disagree with the students' tactics, say the DA and the jury violated the students' right to freedom of speech. However, UC Irvine's law school dean, Urban Chemerinsky, who specializes in constitutional law and has even represented detainees held at Guantanamo, said in a recent LA Times op-ed, quote, "Freedom of speech on campuses and elsewhere is rendered meaningless if speakers can be shouted down by those who disagree." And that, quote, "those who yelled to keep the ambassador from being heard were not engaged in constitutionally protected behavior." However, another UCI professor, Ray Tereda, who has taught courses on the customs and practices of campus protests, said the moderators of Oren's speech did not have the authority to lay out ground rules for politeness and decorum at the outset of the event, and that the student method of protest is a common one. The case of the Irvine 11 has been seen as a test of how far students can go in their on-campus protest actions, and also a test of racial and religious discrimination faced by Muslim students on campuses. The 10 UC Irvine students faced up to a year in prison, but ended up being sentenced to 56 hours of community service, fines, and probation. Joining me in studio now are two members of the Irvine 11, Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah. This is the first time that they've sat down to tell their story to the media. Welcome to Uprising, Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Let's go back to what happened before we get into the whole case. You guys have not really been able to publicly tell your story up until this week. I'd like to hear your description of how you planned the action against Michael Oren when he was giving his speech, because you've been convicted of conspiring to disrupt his speech. How did it all start?
Well, we received word in late January, I believe, that Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, would be coming to the University of California, Irvine, where I go to school, actually. And so we, as students, as a wide body of students, honestly, were extremely concerned at the fact that someone who has been nearly convicted of war crimes, the United Nations has come out against the Israeli attack and bombardment upon Gaza, and has said that what's going on is war crimes. And so as students of conscience, as students who are concerned that the university would allow and would sponsor this type of an event, more so definitely concerned us. So we got together and we planned, and we said we're going to do a protest, because that's what college students do. We protest and we make our voice heard.
And you, when you say we, you mean you as individuals, not you as the Muslim Student Union?
Yeah, it was definitely individuals who did it. And this kind of nuanced discussion of MSU versus individuals and this concept of, oh, you guys lied about it. We never lied about planning the event or planning the protest. What we did was made a clear decision that this is not being put on. We're not protesting as an MSU.
Right.
We're just protesting.
You didn't put out a leaflet.
I was the vice president of MSU at that time. I didn't go to the protest as the vice president of MSU. I went as Usama Shabaik, and I'm going to show my opposition to what Michael Oren has done in the Gaza Strip.
Would you like to add anything to that, guys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from UC Riverside, so I just got contact. I got in contact with some of the guys at UCI, and they informed me of the ambassador coming to speak. So I decided to try and take part in any protest that would happen, and I just went there.
You went as a UC Riverside student, not even as a UCI student.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any access to any of the emails or anything like that that they presented in court.
And yet, you were one of the 10 who faced all of these.
Right. Yeah, and I was charged with conspiracy as well.
Hmm. All right. Well, I want to ask you about what you thought the consequences would be before it all happened. When you went up, when you did the action, standing up one after the other, you shouted accusations of Michael Oren being a war criminal. What did you think would happen to you?
Honestly, none of us, I think, imagined it to get to where it is today.
Yeah, I don't think any of us thought that the district attorney would file grand jury subpoenas, mm-hmm. Harass students, investigate, and really go after students for a few months in order to have people testify. And really drag the case on for 19 months. I don't think anyone expected that.
Well, did you think that the campus police would arrest you?
I thought the campus police would escort us out of the room. I did not expect them to arrest us because I didn't feel that they had any grounds for arresting us. They just could take us out of the room and end it there.
Even a few months before, the UCs were going into like almost chaos over the whole tuition hikes that were taking place. And I remember in November of that year, actually, we had some crazy protests at UCI where students would go into classrooms and police were following behind them. And they would go into the classroom and completely disrupt the classroom, walk out, walk out, walk out. And even one student got into a shoving match with a professor on stage. And we're talking about like 500-person classrooms. Completely, there was no classes like going on at that time. But administration
got arrested. Nobody got arrested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, police were there. Administration was there, and they were just letting it be.
So we figured that our protests would.
Yeah, it was.
It's not abnormal.
So it's a
anymore.
Common occurrence on campuses to do this kind of protest.
Exactly. And that was actual lectures, professors lecturing. This was a political event that was occurring on campus, the Michael Oren incident. Mm-hmm.
Well, Irvin Chemerinsky, who is the UC Irvine Dean of the law school there, has said that what you did not represent freedom of speech because freedom of speech, quote, is rendered meaningless if speakers can be shouted down by those who disagree. He said those who yelled to keep the ambassador from being heard were not engaged in constitutionally protected behavior. He's a constitutional lawyer, and he's basically saying that even though he disagrees with the vehemence that Tony Rakakis went after you guys with, that technically your speech was not protected.
I think Irvin Chemerinsky is contradicting some of the previous statements that he made in the past, like in his entire history of being a constitutional lawyer. Hmm. I don't even know if he watched the entire video because Michael Oren was able to complete his speech ultimately, and our protest lasted for a small segment of the program. And we walked out eventually. We didn't necessarily shut down the entire speech. We protested, we made our remarks, and we walked out. So the entire event was not completely disrupted. So I think when Irvin Chemerinsky makes these kinds of statements, he's going on the assumption of what the 10-minute video or the few clips that he maybe has seen. It would be a good question to ask him if he's watched the entire video.
Well, there's a question of the practice of protests in the form of civil disobedience, and then there's the sort of the way in which these things are pursued by the law. When a group of people goes and sits down in the middle of the road to block traffic, they know they're breaking the law. In fact, that's the point. They know that they're doing a disruptive action because they want to call attention to their cause. Sometimes, as in the case, in fact, in Los Angeles recently, sometimes the district attorney of a city will go after people to make an example of them. Mm-hmm. To discourage that political speech or that political action, those sorts of tactics. So there's one thing to have the laws on the books, but generally those laws aren't enforced because it's an accepted understanding that these are political actions that should be protected. Is that the kind of basis for your defense?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that civil disobedience in its nature is meant to challenge the status quo. If somebody tells you, if the people that want to maintain the status quo tell you how to protest, then that means you're protesting within the boundaries that they've set for you. And that means you're not really challenging the status quo anymore. You're just going along with what they're giving you. So even with our what we've been charged with, California Penal Code 403, that has been enforced, I think, twice in the entire history that it's been on in the law books.
So you knew there would be consequences. You didn't know how far those consequences would
exactly.
lead.
Since we realized that the DA didn't really prosecute anybody before, we didn't think that he would prosecute us now, especially considering the norms and customs and usage of the type of protest that we did before.
Even if you look at the emails themselves that were used in evidence, it clearly says within it, oh, if you do get arrested, don't worry about it. It'll go to the courts and they'll throw it out because this is First Amendment rights. My entire life, I have seen protest after protest after protest on college campuses where students would stand up and yell at a speaker and then leave. And never once did I see anyone arrested, prosecuted. And as I explained, even with the tuition hike protests, this is what happens on mm-hmm. college campuses.
Why were you accusing Michael Oren of being a war criminal? Let's talk about what motivated you, because often in the media circus that happened around this case, the reasons why you guys were protesting weren't explored. I understand at least one of the Irvine 11 had family members who were killed in Gaza by the Israeli forces.
And it's very clear, and we know that Michael Oren was an IDF spokesperson during the Gaza war. We know that he actively participated in the military strategy. So he has a long history of being involved in the Israeli forces, especially in Lebanon in 82. So he's been actively participating in the genocidal policies of the state of Israel. And we knew that. We knew that coming in. What angered us the most is that the university sponsored this guy to come and speak on our campus. And they expected people that have family that have died in Gaza due to Oren's actions. Not to say anything. They expected those students to just come and listen and ask questions. And I think that's what's ridiculous.
I actually had the ability to go to Gaza the summer after the bombardment upon Gaza. And I was able to go into the Gaza Strip, and I was able to see firsthand what had occurred in the Gaza Strip.
Thousands of people were killed, including hundreds of children.
Yeah, 1,400 civilians were killed. And I remember vividly every single building, house, mosque, school was either riddled with bullet holes or completely destroyed. And we're talking about on the second story of houses around the windows. You're seeing windows completely riddled with bullet holes on every single house. I mean, don't tell me there's militants in every single house.
And so that's what motivated you to take this risk.
Yeah, and I even met three girls who had lost, three teenage girls. They had lost all their members of their family, 45 members of their family in one bomb that was dropped on their house. So of course, I mean,
understanding the reality on the ground, we couldn't just sit there and stay quiet.
I'm speaking with Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah, two of the Irvine 11. They have not had the chance to speak out about what happened to them, the case around them, until this week. You guys are all Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You are brown-skinned. Yeah. Your name is Osama.
Yeah. Which came up a lot during trial.
And do you think that all of that played a major role?
Definitely. I mean, what would motivate the district attorney to take on a case that he himself filed as a misdemeanor? That's a disruption protest. There's been many protests before. What would motivate him to take this kind of case? Who put this case on his desk and told him, you need to prosecute these guys and make an example of them? So these are the questions that linger in a lot of people's heads. And I think it's important for us to realize as a community that there are external pressures on political figures, especially somebody like the district attorney, to silence speech when it comes to Israel. When it comes to criticism of Israel, they want to make an example of us to say, look, if you do this, this is what's going to happen to you.
And even if you look at the rhetoric that Tony Rakakis and his office has been using for the past year and a half, in the beginning they likened us towards the KKK, saying all we were doing was just spewing hate speech. And I mean, with all due respect, I think Michael Oren propagating murder is not an expression of free speech, which is what I said. That's not hate speech. I'm calling for peace, and I'm calling for a stop to violence. And then even now, he is still so focused on the case. He recently published an op-ed, I think the other day, where he said, "We will not allow a small group of people to hijack our freedoms." I mean, what are you trying to insinuate with a comment like that?
He's implicitly stating that, you know, he's using the commune or like the Islamophobia that exists in our communities.
Definitely loaded rhetoric.
To sort of, in his own benefit, to try to instigate people to think of us as terrorists, ultimately.
I want to quote Susan Kang Schroeder, spokesperson for the OCDA's office. She told the LA Times that she felt that the defense supporters acted in an intimidating manner during the trial and that the students on trial were defiant after the verdict. She said, quote, "They've shown absolutely no remorse for the fact that they committed a crime." How do you respond to that?
My response is, if standing up for justice, if standing up for truth, if giving a voice to the voiceless is a crime, then so be it. Call me a criminal. I'm not going to feel bad about that. And the judge even knew that we're not going to feel any remorse whatsoever for protesting. If the punitive system or the judicial system wants to make us feel bad for what we did, then they are not accomplishing anything.
One of our co-defendants, Asad Traina, he read a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. right afterwards during the press conference. And the quote, pretty much I'm paraphrasing, went along the lines of, most people walk out of a courthouse after they've been convicted with a crime, you know, sad, down, like they're down on their luck. But he's like, I'm walking out today with a smile on my face because I am proud of the so-called crime that I've committed.
And so she was expressing that you didn't show remorse because, of course, this whole trial and the case seems to be designed towards tamping down on the kinds of actions that you guys undertook. What effect has it had on your activism? Because generally speaking, one would imagine that any ordinary person that goes through this kind of experience may think twice about doing it again, may not want to go through what you've been through for over a year again.
It actually has invigorated, like gives me more motivation to do work now. I'm taking part in a national Students for Justice in Palestine conference, and it's going to happen in New York in October. I'm actively involved in other organizations that advocate for the rights of the Palestinian people. I've actually feel more motivated now to, even more than ever now, to take part in protests, and I can't wait till the probation is over to get back right into it.
Mm. I think definitely we won't be silenced. This is in no way going to hinder our efforts in speaking out and speaking truth to power and really just trying to come up with a better society for all of us to live in.
Let's talk about what you were sentenced with. First of all, you didn't get sentenced to any prison time. Do you think that was a result of the outpouring of support that your case garnered among both free speech advocates and Palestinian rights advocates around the country?
Definitely.
That if it hadn't gotten the attention that it did, maybe that you might be sitting in prison today?
Possibly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to tell what the judge is thinking in the back of his head. But I do have to say, with all due respect to Judge Peter J. Wilson, who was the residing judge over the case, he even made the comment that due to our outstanding character and the fact that we didn't act the way Tony Rakakis is trying to make it out, that we acted as thugs. Which he's used.
Wow. He
called us, this is acts of thuggery, pretty much. He did say these are because of their outstanding character and because they were motivated by sincere beliefs. This does not warrant any prison time. Mm. So I do have to actually thank Judge Wilson for that. Mm.
And so it was 56 hours of community service, fines, you know, running upwards of $100, but then also probation. How long is the probation and what does it mean?
It's 3 years of informal probation, which the informal part pretty much means that a probation officer, you don't have to like check in with a probation officer. And then if we do our community service by January 31st, it goes down to a year of probation. And in pretty much just you can't commit any type of crime.
So if you're at a protest and there's cops around, then you have to really worry.
Make sure not to get arrested, basically.
Right. Yeah. So in some ways, it does restrict your ability to do political activism for the time being, at least for 1 to 2, 3 years, potentially. And how has it affected your education and your future careers? Because this is the kind of thing that can not only stress out somebody as you're studying for exams and doing homework, but also does it have any effect on your future careers?
I mean, as far as my education, since the event, actually, my grades got better. I don't know about Osama, but my grades got much better. I've gotten straight A's for the past like three quarters. It's like, and professors kind of know me more now. But as far as career goes, I'm sure that, you know, it might have some effect on when you're applying for
what's
a job.
What's your major?
Well, political science, international affairs. And I know so that if I'm applying for grad school or a job, you'd have to check that, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Right.
So that might have an effect. But if they ask you what crime you've been, you know, convicted of, then I could just tell them. Mm-hmm.
And Osama?
I'm actually currently applying to law school, and I'm actually writing about it in my personal statement. So it's not like something
so
I'm trying to hide.
So you can use this as a way to get in.
Yeah, but
You've gotten an intimate understanding of constitutional law.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something now that has made me want to study constitutional law a little bit more to be able to better understand all the legal rhetoric that's being used throughout this entire case. And in terms of like future job opportunities and things like that, I think if it closes any doors in my life, then it was probably better for me to not have opened those doors to begin with. It's probably a job I wouldn't have wanted to have.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah, two of the 11 students who were charged with disrupting a meeting. The 10 were eventually convicted of disrupting a meeting, public meeting, as well as conspiring to disrupt a public meeting. And the gag order has finally been lifted now that the case has come to a close. And so they're joining us in studio to discuss how it all took place. Well, let's also talk a little bit about the local action around this case, because this all happened in Orange County, a county of contradictions in many ways, you know, home to very wealthy and often conservative people, not just in the population, but also elected officials, especially people who hold power. But then in the population, having a very diverse population, having an immigrant population. Do you think that the geographic context of what where your case took place played a major role?
Definitely.
Definitely.
No doubt about it. I think even the jury pool that we were faced with from the very beginning, there was just the fact that my name is Osama, and ironically enough, the case started nearly around the weekend of 9/11. Definitely
the anniversary
of 9/11. Yeah, definitely. I think could have possibly played a role. And the fact, I mean, if you look at any other university, look at the University of Chicago, where they did the exact same thing to Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel at that time. Nothing happened to him.
So they also did a.
We actually styled our protest after their protest, because we saw, okay, they're just getting escorted out by police. And they had, I think, almost 30 people
stand up one after the other.
And absolutely no consequences, no nothing. You look at all over the country, different universities, this happens every single day. But I guess we were singled out. And I guess the factor is this happened in Orange County.
And certainly it's a perfect storm of so many different things coming up, as you said. You know, the nature of the protest, the location, the university. What about the reaction on the campus of UCI? You're at UC Riverside, but Tahir and then Osama, you're at UCI. Was there campus awareness of this story, and did you get support, or did you also get attacked?
We definitely got support from the students, from a tremendous amount of students actually came out in support of us. And we did get a nice backlash from the administration.
From the administration? Was this student backlash?
There was from certain groups of students who are more pro-Zionist on campus. Definitely they were offended by the protest that someone would come out against Michael Oren in this fashion. But from the activist students on campus, none whatsoever. They were very proud that something like this would happen at UCI.
In a way, it's put UCI on the map.
Yeah.
and then also from the local community in Orange County, there's a large Muslim population in Orange County. Did you find that this motivated a lot of folks to come out for the various rallies as well as at the court?
Definitely. I mean, the support that we've received from the Muslim community in Orange County has been amazing. It really, really strengthened us, and it motivated us to continue. And really just the organization and the way they came out in support, they came to the courthouse in huge numbers, to the point where there was people waiting outside to come and be seated.
In a 200-something person court, like the courtroom fits over 200 people, and there's still people waiting outside.
Packed.
Yeah,
and there's probably more people that wanted to come, but just decided not to because it was so packed.
And your supporters were described as intimidating by Susan Kang Schroeder.
If that's the case, I mean, at one point in time, the audience, I guess, acted out of place for a courtroom because they clapped for one of the closing arguments. If that was the intimidating part, I can't really. I mean, I guess maybe for her that's intimidating.
But then again, we take whatever Susan Schroeder says with a grain of salt.
Yeah, she's the one who likened us to the KKK.
Wow.
So yeah.
She's not exactly the brightest wow. Star.
All right. Well, finally, any last thoughts to our listeners? Things that you'd like to leave this whole case with? I mean, this experience has probably been one of the most important ones of your lives, of your political lives at least.
I mean, what I have to say is that if the university, any university for that matter, decides to bring a speaker like Michael Oren, you better believe that students like us are going to be there, ready to protest, ready to do something. The state of Israel is committing grave violations of human rights and humanitarian law. And the people are starting to realize this. And they are not welcoming people who spew their propaganda and try to whitewash Israel's crimes.
And I guess also just to highlight one thing, because I've seen a lot in the media, is over the case of the 11th one of the Irvine 11 and what exactly happened with
him. Right. Let me just mention that this was the person who didn't get – he apparently finished his community service, right?
I'm actually not sure if he finished community service, but most people think that he took a plea bargain. What actually ended up happening was that the DA used privileged communications, which led to the judge actually dismissing three of the top attorneys from the district attorney's office, as well as the lead investigator from the case. And they used privileged communications between him and his attorneys in order to charge him. So once the judge said that was privileged, the DA said, you know what, we'll drop all the charges against you if you do community service.
Wow.
None of us got that offer.
Wasn't that 11th person did anything less than what you guys did?
No, he didn't plead guilty or anything.
They gave him an offer that none of us were given.
Yeah.
Because they violated the law.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow. Osama, you're going to go on to law. Has this eroded your faith at all in the legal system in the U.S.?
Honestly, the 2 day, or about, I think it was maybe like 2 days before our verdict was given, I heard the news of Troy Davis. And that was probably one of the most disheartening news I've heard in the past 2 years.
Were you following that case?
It was tough to follow because we were in court nearly all the time. No cell phones in court, anything, or internet. So it's tough to follow, but I was trying to keep up to date with it. And it was just, it was heartbreaking to see something like that happen, where someone, where there's no physical evidence against him, be executed and honestly murdered. And so definitely some of my faith in the justice system has been eroded, but it doesn't mean I'm gonna stop working for a better society, for a better justice system, working for people like Troy Davis, working for students who are no longer able to go to college because the UCs want to raise tuition to $20,000 within the next 4 years. I will not stay silent on issues like that whatsoever.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah. Best of luck to the two of you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
I've been speaking with Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah, two of the Irvine 11 students, speaking out for the first time in an exclusive interview, telling their side of the story about the case against them that garnered national media attention. You can watch a video of my interview with these two students at uprisingradio.org. After this short break, we'll hear this week's Rethink Reviews by Jonathan Kim. And then Mark Levine joins us to give us a report back from Tunisia, the site of the first revolution of the Arab Spring. Tunisians will vote in their first elections after the revolution on October 23rd. Stay tuned.
I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
What kind of cancer is it? What's the name of the cancer?
Some rare kind of cancer.
What's it called?
Schwannoma. I knew this.
Schwannoma?
Schwannoma.
It's schwannoma? What's schwannoma?
That means tumor, basically.
Your chances? What are your odds?
I don't know. I mean, I looked it up and it said 50-50, but that's like the internet, so...
It's not that bad. That's better than I thought. You'll be fine, man. You're young. Young people beat cancer all the time. Every celebrity beats cancer. Lance Armstrong, he keeps getting it.
Yeah.
He's fine.
Yeah.
Guy from Dexter, he's okay.
Cancer isn't something to laugh about. And when we think of movies about people with terminal illnesses, we mostly think of inspirational tales about appreciating life and the indomitability of the human spirit, or weepy tearjerkers about love conquering death. The film 50-50 takes the terminal illness movie into new territory, first by combining it with an only recently identified genre, the bromance comedy, and second, by the fact that 50-50's afflicted protagonist is barely in his late 20s, an age where it's hard enough to get perspective on your life, let alone face its early end. Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays Adam, a soft-spoken, unadventurous, unremarkable guy living a comfortable, relatively average life working for a radio station. Adam's relationship with Rachel, his attractive artist girlfriend, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, is progressing to the next level, and for entertainment, Adam has his buddy Kyle, a juvenile but hilarious Lothario played by Seth Rogen. Adam goes to a doctor, where a scan reveals the shocking news that Adam's pain is from a tumor along his spine caused by a rare form of cancer, and the prognosis isn't good, with only a 50-50 chance of survival. As someone who's traded a more interesting life for a mundane one he can control, Adam does his best to absorb this horrible news and not make a big deal of it. Unfortunately, Adam's mom, played by Angelica Houston, is an over-involved worrier, a job she's grown used to while taking care of a husband with Alzheimer's. While Rachel initially pledges to stand by Adam, it soon becomes obvious that being Adam's primary support is more than their relationship can handle. Meanwhile, Kyle thinks Adam should use his cancer to score sympathy points with women and get them both laid, and the therapist assigned to help Adam deal with his condition, played by Anna Kendrick, looks to be barely out of college. 50-50 is based on the true story of Will Reiser, the film's screenwriter, who also was diagnosed with cancer while in his 20s. At the time, he and Seth Rogen were working together as young writers, and Rogen watched, as his character does, as his friend deteriorated in front of him. As a 20-something ready to take on the world, Rogen could only respond to this by falling back on what he knew best, movies and comedy, joking with Reiser about his condition and encouraging him to write a script about it. Since then, Rogen has become Hollywood's clown prince based on his roles in Judd Apatow's man-child comedies, and he's a producer on 50-50. This might be what gives 50-50 its wonderfully intimate, personal feel. It's not a movie that makes grand statements about what life is and how we should live it. It's about what happens when a young, fairly uninteresting guy who never wanted to cause a fuss or take risks is faced with a situation where everyone is fussing over him as he faces the biggest risk of his life. And 50-50 does this with tremendous heart and humor that never feels manipulative, jokey, or contrived, with terrific performances by the entire cast. Men usually only shed tears at movies involving sports, but 50-50 will have both men and women laughing and crying, which is often the hallmark of a great film. But it's hard not to see 50-50 in terms of the evolution of its co-producer, Seth Rogen. While there's still enough dirty humor to show that movie's biggest man-child hasn't fully grown up, 50-50 shows that he also has a grasp of emotionally complex adult moments, while staying true to the popular Apatow theme that it's your buddies, not your significant others, who always have your back. While cancer is serious business, 50-50 shows that, with the right touch, it can also be hilarious. 50-50 is rated R and opens today. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink review for Uprising. To bother me, oh, now.
Broken Bones by Rooftop Underground from Roseville, California. Find out more about the band at ReverbNation.com/TheRooftopUnderground or check the featured music section of UprisingRadio.org later today. And before we go to our next interview, I want to announce the screening, the KPFK-organized screening of the new documentary film American Teacher this Saturday, October 1st, starting at 11 a.m. at the AMC Lowe's Broadway 4, 1441 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica. There are still tickets available to the event. There's going to be an audience Q&A moderated by KPFK host Margaret Prescott and the producer and co-founder of the 826 National Writing Program, Nineveh Caligari, as well as one of the teachers profiled in the film, Eric Benner from Texas. Tickets are available today until noon through kpfk.org. The donation for a pair of tickets is $75. Single tickets are available for $50, and all proceeds will benefit your favorite radio station, KPFK. There will also be whatever remaining tickets available at the door on Saturday starting at 10 a.m. The film American Teacher is a definitive look at the state of the teaching profession in America and offers a constructive solution to the education crisis. The film is narrated by Matt Damon and co-produced by Dave Eggers. You're listening to Uprising, and up next, a report on Tunisia. The first country to overthrow its ruler, setting off the Arab Spring revolts, is facing the first test of its revolution. Tunisia will hold elections on October 23rd to pick an assembly that will write a new constitution. Tunisia's longtime ruler, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, was overthrown after more than two decades in power by a broad grassroots uprising on January 14th, 2011. Now, more than 100 political parties have formed in preparation for the elections, which will shape Tunisia's post-revolution future. In an interview with Associated Press, the Tunisian Foreign Minister, Mouldi Kefi, called the elections, quote, a landmark in the modern history of Tunisia. Kefi addressed the United Nations General Assembly last week, pledging to uphold the principles of the revolution and complete a transition to democracy. Since the fall of Ben Ali, there have been scattered protests and strikes leading the country's transitional government to revive the old emergency laws. However, in recent weeks, the unrest has quieted in preparation for the elections. Despite the U.S.'s long-standing support for the dictatorial regime that was ousted, President Barack Obama is eager to embrace the new government, with a meeting with Tunisian Prime Minister Beji Caid El Sabzi planned for October 7th. The White House has said Obama will discuss, quote, America's strong support for Tunisia's historic transition to democracy, as well as a broad range of bilateral and regional issues of mutual interest. A delegation of U.S. congressmen headed by California Republican David Dreyer traveled to Tunisia this week, saying that the Tunisian revolution was a defeat against al-Qaeda and announcing the presence of American observers during the elections. Joining me now from a studio in Irvine, California, is weekly columnist for Al Jazeera English, Mark Levine. He's a professor of history at UC Irvine, and he is the author of Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. He just returned from a trip to Tunisia. Welcome to Uprising, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
So first tell us about your trip to Tunisia. How long were you there? And while you were there, did you have conversations with ordinary people as well as members of the transitional government? What was your experience like?
Well, this was my second trip in the last 3 months. In fact, I didn't really have any conversations with people from the government. It was mostly artists and intellectuals and political and human rights activists that I was speaking with, just trying to understand the dynamics of the transition from below, and especially compared to Egypt, where I've spent a fair amount of time, to try to see what the differences are between the two countries, especially the labor movement and human rights movements and the role of artists in the two revolutions.
In a way, do you feel that Tunisia is really a test case for all of the other various Arab uprisings, even though, you know, there are many similarities, but there are lots of differences? Is Tunisia being heavily watched, or is it not getting as much media attention as it deserves, given that it's about to launch into elections?
Yeah, I think it's actually not getting the attention it deserves. On the one hand, Egypt has gotten most of the attention because it's such a bigger country, and especially in the West, our consciousness of this so-called revolutionary spring emerged with the Egyptian revolts rather than Tunis. But they are having elections on the 23rd of October, if that's still the date they're going to have them. And you know, most of the processes that are going on in Egypt are happening also in Tunisia. And I think it's really important to see how Tunisia is playing out, because in some ways Tunisia still remains the most hopeful situation. The military is not as powerful. The economic dynamics in the country are a bit more open than in a country like Egypt, because the previous regime was really, at the end, such a mafia state that dismantling this regime in some ways has proved easier than a much bigger country like Egypt, where the state itself was so involved in dominating the economy in a very corrupt manner. So Tunis is in a way more hopeful. And because it's a bit smaller and more manageable, I think there's a lot that's going to be learned from how these elections play out, how the parties are able to form and challenge what remains of the old system. And it should be a bellwether for what will happen in other countries in the next 6 or 8 months as they move towards elections.
Now, didn't the government have to reintroduce emergency laws in Tunisia that were exactly the sorts of laws that the ousted regime relied on, because there's been ongoing unrest in Tunisia?
Well, it's the same thing also that's happened in Egypt. The governments have, and in Tunisia, in fact, it started almost immediately after the revolution, that protests and especially strikes continued. And the government really has no vocabulary, in a way, to deal with these kinds of protests except to resort to old measures. And the way civil society has pushed back in Tunisia is quite interesting, because they've been able to do it more forcefully than has happened in Egypt. There's certainly been some arrest of bloggers and other things, but compared to the, you know, thousands and thousands of activists who've been arrested in Egypt since the revolution there. In fact, more people were arrested since Mubarak's overthrow in Egypt than Mubarak arrested in the last 10 years. You don't have that kind of comparable level of oppression in Tunisia, and there's much more openness for people to really think of alternatives to challenge the system.
And it's also being reported now that some of these strikes and other types of unrest have calmed down in the lead up to the elections. There's a lot of talk, I understand, of unity, of Tunisian unity. Is that what you saw as well?
Well, we have to remember that, as in Egypt, the roots of these of the revolution in Tunisia are economic. You know, people use the word dignity as one of the cornerstones of the revolution. But this really was an anti-neoliberal revolt. You have people like Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who so many people were upset when he was arrested, not because of his alleged crime, but because he was considered someone who was so friendly to the Arab and African world, and now he would be removed from the scene. But when you start doing the research, you see that he was a very good friend of Ben Ali. He was someone who constantly told the world how well Tunisia was doing, when in fact, for the vast majority of Tunisians, the situation was getting worse. And that's, of course, continued since the revolution. But for now, at least, there seems to be a kind of hope that there can be some systematic or systemic change in the political economy of the country. And what really, you know, encouraged me was, for example, I was in Sidi Bouzid, which is the place where the revolution started, when Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire. And I was at the local labor council, where many of the local labor people had to revolt against their own leaders, who were very close to the regime, in order to stage the protests that eventually spread throughout the country. And now there are all kinds of groups meeting there, developing very sophisticated agendas for, you know, parliamentary reform, for reforming the economy in a way that works better for the majority of Tunisians. And this is happening all over. But of course, the one thing that remains troubling, I suppose, is that in the south of the country, where you have the mining industry, which is one of the most important industries and where there have been protests for years, you don't get the kind of coverage, you don't get the kind of analysis coming out of there, simply because they're hard to get to. They're not like Tunis or Bizerte, or, you know, towns that are nice to go to. And if you're not there all the time on the ground, it's very hard to get a picture of how really the dynamics are changing. So it's up to really the Tunisian, a lot of my Tunisian colleagues who are constantly, or at least routinely, making the trips there to stay in touch with the local labor activists and others, and help shape a political discourse that doesn't marginalize them, because it was precisely their marginalization for the past decade and a half, especially, that helped, you know, feed the fire of the revolution.
I'm speaking with Mark Levine, a weekly columnist for Al Jazeera English, author of Heavy Metal Islam Resistance and the Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. He's also a professor of Middle East History, Culture and Islamic Studies at UC Irvine. Just returned from a trip to Tunisia ahead of elections. Tunisia was the first country that overthrew its ruler as and began the wave of Arab Spring revolution. revolts. Now, you mentioned Mohamed Bouazizi, who was the fruit and vegetable vendor who literally self-immolated himself, sparking the revolt against President Ben Ali. And he was in many ways representative of the millions of unemployed Tunisians. Just staying on the issue of the economy for a bit, how do you see Tunisia's economic future? Is it, do you think, going to be independent of Western neoliberal structures, of corporate investors, etc., in a way that may set off a new trend? Or do you think that it might be business as usual, given that President Obama is currently courting the prime minister of Tunisia and hoping to foment ties with them, probably in a bid to try to keep financial ties open?
You know, I think it's impossible for Tunisia to remove itself, obviously, from the global economy. The problem is its role has been largely as a provider of raw materials, which is, of course, a very old role for African countries to play, and also tourism. And both of those sectors really reinforced the mafia structure of the old regime. And you know, Tunisia still is going to have to sell a lot of phosphate. It's still going to have to sell a lot of minerals and olives and other kinds of agricultural products as a main staple for getting revenue. The question is, how does the revenue generated from these industries get divided among the majority of Tunisians? So it's not so much that it has to, you know, get rid of existing sectors. It needs to reform the way the wealth that these sectors produce is generated within society. The same thing, the tourism economy in Tunis, which, like so many developing countries, winds up providing very little for most local people, even though it's touted as being a panacea for these kinds of countries. And people are absolutely aware of this. So many of the activists and would-be politicians I've spoken with are trying to figure out a way to create an economic system, which hasn't existed because Tunisia, even more than Egypt, really was like a mafia state. You had a family and certain clans tied to them that took a huge percentage of the economy. What people are trying to understand is how you can take an export-oriented economy and make it work for the majority of people. This is a very hard trick in the developing world because these systems were set up specifically not to benefit most of the local people, but rather a small elite. It can be done. It just depends on whether the political system opens up enough, in fact, to allow these new parties and these new interest groups to have the power to reshape the economy in a way that could benefit more Tunisians. Obviously, France is going to do everything possible to make sure that doesn't happen. The U.S., the IMF, the World Bank all have an interest in preventing that from happening. But at least finally, Tunisians can speak about this openly. I think most people understand what's at stake here. I think even groups which in the West everyone is focusing on, like Ennahda, the Islamist movement that was illegal until after the revolution but is very popular, understands that it has to have some kind of economic program that is in some way populist and benefits most people. And this is going to be how politicians are judged. Even if there's just a formal democracy without very deep roots to begin with, if the new parliament in Tunisia, and same thing's going to happen in Egypt, can't fairly quickly be shown to take the system and move it towards a kind of system that benefits all these Tunisians who suffered from massive unemployment and the problems you mentioned, there is going to be what many Tunisians are talking to me as a second revolution. Some people are predicting that revolution will happen the next day after the elections because people are going to be disappointed so quickly in the inability of a new system to do that they're going to hit the streets again and push for much more radical change.
What about the role of young people who were very involved, of course, in the revolution? But are enough of them participating in the electoral process, either through campaigning or through actively running for positions?
That's a very good question. Young people are very active in all cadres. I stop by, you know, the offices of several political parties, and you do have kind of the 40 or 50-year-old men, you know, often who are at the top in the office, but it's the cadres of young people out there who are doing not just the yeoman's work or the grunt work of getting literature out and trying to get people in, but also shaping the agenda. Tunis has a very educated population. It's worth pointing out that Mohamed Bouazizi most likely did not have a college degree, as he's been portrayed as having. And there's a kind of mythology about him that's quite interesting. But even if he didn't, so many young people do. And they have it in, you know, I met with a couple of young women who both had degrees in computer engineering. And, you know, just so much energy and ability to try to reshape the country. And if I'm hopeful for Tunisia, it's because these young people have the ability to reshape this economy to one that's more equitable, and they have the means to create the kinds of new industries and new sectors that can give prosperity, a wider prosperity, much firmer roots. So as long as they stay active and they show no signs of just withdrawing, that's for sure, it's going to be very hard for the remnants of the old system to retain, you know, anything close to the level of economic power and the ability to concentrate the wealth that they had in the old system. I think that's probably different in Egypt, where, of course, young activists are still very, very important. The April 6th movement just, I think, yesterday came out saying it won't participate in the parliamentary elections because it doesn't like the system. But there's so many more entrenched interests in Egypt, and it's, you know, eight times the size of Tunisia, that it's probably going to be harder for young people to reshape the political economy of the country, you know, in a few years towards what they know is necessary to help Egypt rebuild itself. In Tunisia, I think it could happen more quickly.
I'm speaking with history professor at UC Irvine, Mark Levine. He's also a weekly columnist for Al Jazeera English, just returned from Tunisia, where elections will be held in late October. Now, the Tunisia shares a border with Libya, where there is still a quite violent conflict taking place with the collaboration of the U.S. and NATO, a very different kind of revolution unfolding there. How much of the violence plaguing Libya is affecting Tunisia, if at all?
Well, one thing that's very interesting, I was there during the height of the fighting in Libya, and there were many, many Libyans throughout Tunisia. Another thing that most people don't realize is that the Tunisian revolution, in some ways, is a product of Saif Gaddafi. You know, there was already incredible unemployment in Tunisia among young people. Tens of thousands, if not more, Tunisians were working, quote-unquote, illegally in Libya. And last year, when Saif Gaddafi decided he wanted a more orderly and rational, quote-unquote, economic system, late in the year, he forced out tens and tens of thousands of Tunisian workers who went back to towns like Sidi Bouzid, which already had high unemployment, and just made the situation that much worse. Along with them came Islamists and others who helped start some less pleasant movements, some Salafi movements in Tunisia. But the link between, you know, Gaddafi trying to create this neoliberal kind of order, Gaddafi the son, pushing all these Tunisians out who start a revolution, which then helps inspire the revolution against him, is quite telling. Tunisians were very aware of what's happening in Libya. At least the ones I've seen in the cities I've been to are not trying to judge Libyans. You know, no one's saying, oh, we did it nonviolently, you should have done it the same way. In fact, Tunisians, last time I was there, after Gaddafi was at least ousted, were very, very happy about what's happened in Libya. Almost every kiosk in Tunis is selling Libyan flags. You know, Tunisians have suddenly become Libyan in a way. Hats and flags and pins, everyone is sharing in that revolution. And there's a feeling that Libya has now joined them. Their neighbor has now joined them. And there's some pride in that. So I think, you know, Tunisians are not trying to judge. Of course, if you talk to them about NATO involvement, and once you get into the nuts and bolts, most politically aware people would be at some level critical of that, or at least not at all, you know, imagining that NATO did that because there's some basic love for the Libyan people. But on the other hand, I think a lot of people, you know, because they knew Gaddafi next door, understand really how horrific his regime was. A lot of Tunisians worked in Libya and experienced this firsthand. And you know, many, many people, at least, that I spoke to who are not, let's say, hardcore leftists, you know, felt that if that's what was necessary, that's what was necessary. And the main thing is that Libyans can be free and to build their own society.
Well, finally, Mark Levine, let me ask you whether you are hopeful for the future of Tunisia. It does sound like you are, because often what comes after the revolution is even more important than the revolution itself. And there have been so many instances where revolutions have happened only to have what's risen out of the ashes be a replica of the initial structure. Do you see a danger of that in Tunisia, or is there much more reason to be hopeful there?
I think Tunisia is probably the most hopeful country out of all these countries that are undergoing change right now, certainly more than Egypt, where I think the pro-democracy movements are going to have a much harder time, you know, really restructuring this incredibly powerful system that still retains power in Egypt. In Tunis, I think there really is a chance. Activists have been very hopeful. I talked to many people in the human rights community. And, you know, they're hopeful, although they're also worried that, you know, people are not necessarily understanding what's at stake. But then again, the fact that you could have, when I was there, there was a big human rights conference. On the one hand, it was covered on the national news, which is amazing in and of itself. On the other hand, they invited, people from the regime who quite recently were their oppressors. So there's always this dynamic. This is not a kind of revolution like the Russian Revolution where you don't just decapitate the regime, you uproot every structure. It's not that kind of revolution, which is probably a good thing because it means there's no one group that has all the power. And there's going to have to be a lot of negotiation between various social forces. And if that can happen without too much outside interference, which is crucial, I think Tunisia actually could make a move, towards not just formal democracy, which will most likely happen, but towards a restructuring of the economy that will deal with the most basic problems in the country. And that's actually going to be the thing that decides whether this revolution succeeds or not in the long term.
And what's the best place for listeners to get a hold of your writing?
Well, they can go to my Al Jazeera profile, which I have roughly columns every week, or they can go to my website, culturejamming.org.
And we'll post those on uprisingradio.org later today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Mark Levine, a weekly columnist for Al Jazeera English and a professor of history at UC Irvine. He's also the author of Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance, and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. He's just returned from a trip to Tunisia. You can find out more about his work online at culturejamming.org. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Khalil Gibran once said, "Rebellion without truth is like spring in a bleak, arid desert." That's Khalil Gibran. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us on Facebook and Twitter, as well as on our own website at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday at 8.